Thank you for tuning in to episode 147 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember that you'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're listening until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate one time via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can see patreon.com/infectiousmyth to make monthly donations. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any topic I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. And now for some feedback. Lawrence, by email, wrote, I've listened to Terry Michael on pre-exposure prophylaxis, that was number 133, Martin Walker on dirty medicine, 98, and Stefan Lanker, There Are No Viruses, 97. I found these talks very helpful, and I'm sure I will listen to others as time goes on. And then Lawrence gave me a list of suggestions for future guests. Laura wrote about episode 145, which was the story of the Whitaker family and shaken baby syndrome. She wrote, good show, David, but awful what is happening to these folks. Incomprehensible the sentence Joe received. Thanks for your feedback. I do appreciate it. I'd like to know if you think I'm doing a good job, if there's areas for improvement, and in particular, interesting people that I can interview. And the type of people I like to interview are generally people who have something really important to say that's not being covered very well by the mainstream media, if at all. We'll get to this week's interview in a couple of minutes. It's also on what appears to be a major injustice of the so-called justice system. One thing you'll probably note throughout the show is that there were some audio problems. My guest was using a cell phone and it cut out a few times. And so there are a few places where her voice is barely audible. I did try to fix as many of those problems as I could, but a few remained. You'll probably notice the one time where I appeared to disagree with the guest, which is where she referred to the system of science as about truth. And I kind of reacted saying that the medical system isn't all that is cracked up to be. And actually, it's a very important point with the interview that's coming up, as well as, for example, interview 145 with Charlotte Whitaker. The medical system plays a critical role in a lot of the injustices of the justice system, whether it's shaken baby syndrome or false allegations of sexual assault that are backed up by a medical opinion that turns out not to be accurate. There are many legal cases that rely on expert witness testimony, and the testimony is only as good as the expert witness. And particularly with doctors who testify in court, there's a tendency for them to want to help prove the case as opposed to stand up and say what the truth was. And I think it's pretty clear in the upcoming interview that there was no medical evidence, and yet the person who was in charge of presenting that evidence, in this case to the police, stated that there was a sexual assault despite the fact that there was no evidence of such. And so something relatively trivial was misinterpreted in order to help the police achieve a conviction. And that shouldn't be what the justice system is about. It shouldn't be about the more convictions we get, the better the system is. It should be about achieving justice. And if that means more less people are in jail, that may be a good thing, because I think there are a lot of people in jail for things they didn't do or for invented crimes that didn't harm anybody, such as smoking a little weed. Another aspect of the justice system, which is also illustrated with the upcoming interview, is the role of power, money and power, in obtaining justice. America has a president who's bragged about sexually assaulting women. He has not been charged or convicted for what appear to be crimes against women. And he's protected by the fact that a lot of women don't even want to try to lay charges or try to complain about somebody so powerful, because they know he has the power to make their life miserable. But if you are an honest person with no power, you may find that the justice system uses you to obtain, as our guest intimates, to obtain convictions that make them look good. Maybe it helps with promotions. Maybe it helps with re-election if they're an elected justice official. And all of these things go directly against the supposed purpose of the justice system, which is to achieve justice, to separate truth from fiction, and to find a punishment when there is a crime that's appropriate, and to find people innocent when there is no crime. Let's now go to a very interesting interview. I hope you find it as interesting and informative as I did. When you were 8, Chennaiya, you uttered words that put your father behind bars for a 20 to 40-year sentence. You later said that your mother had put those words, which said that your father had sexually assaulted you, in your mouth. But the justice system still insists that what you said then was true. Thank you for joining me today, Chennaiya, to talk about this.
Mm-hmm. You're very welcome.
And so your father was accused of sexually assaulting you when you were 8 years old, and you were the prosecution's star witness.
Yes.
So how did you end up being persuaded to go on the witness stand when you now say that what you said was not true?
That's the very interesting part, because now that I'm older and I spoke with a couple of people from the committee that was supposed to review my dad's case.
Did the committee that reviewed your father's case with an eye to see whether he should get a new trial or be found innocent ask you how you were able to consistently give the same story?
They did. They asked me the same thing, the committee that was supposed to review my dad's case. They asked me the same thing as far as how was I able to keep repeating the same story, and how did I know so many things. And the truth behind it is that the story kind of, it was built upon, it was like lies upon more lies upon more lies. And then once it got into the prosecution's hands, it was kind of like, okay, well, we're just going to take this staircase of lies and we're going to define it more with more legal terms to make it really stick. And there was a point in time where I did say that none of this had happened, but that was ignored. And there was a point in time where I was offered a red mountain bike because that's what I had wanted. And there was a officer, I'm not sure exactly who the officer was, but they had asked me, what is something that I really wanted? And I remember at the time I said a red mountain bike. I have no idea why I wanted a mountain bike or a red one. But that's what I had wanted, and I remember the cop telling me, he's like, well, as long as you do what you're supposed to, then you'll get what you want.
The police asked you what you wanted, and you said a red mountain bike, and then they said you could get it if you did what you were supposed to?
He didn't specifically say you can get it if you do what you're supposed to. He pretty much was like, do what you're supposed to do and you'll be able to get what you want.
Right. And what you were supposed to to do was...
Was answer the questions that the prosecutor were asking me correctly, because we had been through this whole question series before. And I had said, no, it didn't happen. And that's when I remembered that we took a little break, and they talked to me on the side, and I really don't remember. I remember that. And he was just like, what's something that you want? I said, I want something around. Like, and he was like, do what you're supposed to do, and you'll be able to get what you want.
Which is pretty close. To an 8-year-old, that's a promise that you're going to get a red mountain bike.
Right, and you know what the strange thing is? Is that I asked about the mountain bike, and I didn't get the mountain bike until I was, I want to say 15. I think, no, maybe it was 12. One of those ages. My mom actually got me the red mountain bike when, for Christmas.
Right.
Or it could have been for my birthday. My birthday's in December, too. But I remember getting the red bike, and it was so terrible because I couldn't even really ride it. And I kept it locked away in my grandmother's shop. And then to this day, I still don't know what happened to that red bike.
But your mother had heard you saying that that's what you wanted.
Mm-hmm. And I got what I wanted.
Yes. There's an excellent article in New York Magazine, I think from 2014, that talks about this. And they said that initially, in some of your earlier testimony, you had said things like, he put his pee-pee in my pee-pee, but later you were saying, he put his penis in my vagina.
Right.
And
that goes to what I was saying, where it was just like, lies on top, lies on top, lies, and then it was just kind of like, they took the lies, and they were like, okay, let's make it more legal terms, you know?
So you were coached as an 8-year-old on the proper anatomical terms for something that didn't happen to you.
There were dolls involved and everything, They had like the little wooden artistic dolls.
Right. I mean, what did you know? I mean, do you remember what you knew about sex when you were 8 years old?
I don't remember what I knew about sex. But I remember the questioning with a lot of, okay... was it in show point on the doll where your father put his pee-pee? And I would either point to the mouth, or I would point to, you know, the bottom pubic area of the doll, or I would point to the rear pubic part of the doll.
Right, which is exactly what they wanted. I mean, did they have any other evidence in this trial except your testimony?
My grandmother took me to a doctor. She took me down there to the doctor, to the health center.
Right.
And there was no evidence of a torn hymen or any aggressive sexual nature or anything like that. All they had was a little redness that I had, which now that I'm older, I found out, you know, the redness that they were talking about, I had just used, so I wiped. Or I could have been for too long. You know what I mean? It was a very, like, it was kind of like, they took like a rusty nail and from wear and tear, and then they decided, oh, we're going to use this as evidence. That's kind of how they did it.
Well, yeah, I guess if you looked at the private parts of a lot of little girls, you'd probably find a fair number of them had red areas where maybe their underwear.
Right. I'm like, I could have wiped myself too hard. I'm gonna be honest, I don't even remember at 8 years old if I wiped myself. I don't know.
Yes.
And, I hope I did, but
right.
I don't know.
And kids, you know, if there's a bit of an itch, kids have a tendency to scratch themselves. So, yeah, a little bit of redness is not exactly specific. And if there had been a sexual assault, if you had been raped by your father, then there should have been evidence that he'd penetrated you either vaginally or anally. And they said both, basically, in the trial.
Right? Yes. And then the other, I don't know legal terms like that, but to me it feels more like real, is when the detectives lied to my father during his interrogation.
Right.
And they told him that they found his semen in my mouth.
Right. And your father, I feel really sorry for people, innocent people get dragged into the system because, of course, you kind of trust the system. And he tried to explain that. He said, well, maybe...
Right, and they held that against him.
Right, maybe I had had sex with my wife and she took some of my semen and put it in your mouth to try to frame me. Like, instead of denying it, because I don't think, from what I read in this article, I mean, tell me if you think the same thing, but it seemed like he couldn't conceive that the police were lying to him, that thought didn't cross his mind.
Like, to me, even though I've had talks with him, and I tell him, I said, that's impossible because it never happened, you know what I mean? But back then, I'm like, my dad, he probably was kind of like, well, if you found that, then this is probably how you found it. I don't know how you found it. Like, I feel like that's probably how he was saying it. Like, okay, I'm going to tell you maybe this, but I know that doesn't make sense. Because that they don't tell you is how long they had him being interrogated. Because my father had said that it had been quite some hours and that, like, he was out of it. He was tired of being interrogated. What bothers me about the whole situation is don't go into detail about how long they were interrogating my father, because my father told me that it was many hours where he was like, no, it didn't happen. No, no, no. And then after some hours, after 3 hours, he was just like, well, if that's what you found, then I don't know how you found it. If I had to come up with a reason, this would be the reason behind it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I think if you trust that, you know, the police have an issue and they're dealing with you seriously and honestly, then you have to try to explain how this thing happened because you know you're innocent. And so you try to explain it, which is actually a big mistake. But how could you know it's a mistake unless you have some experience with how...
Right, unless you're a lawyer.
Yes. Or unless
and
you...
And him as a man, like, if I was dealing with the police, I'm not going to feel like I should have my guard up. I'm not going to feel like the police are going to lie to me about something. And that's where I'm like, that's where the issues come in as far as social injustices when it comes to back then and nowadays. I don't think that cops should be able to lie to people.
No, I don't, because I mean, how can you get real information?
On top of that, you're giving him a lie, and then you're justifying your means of whatever he says about that lie. Because if my father would have kept saying, no, it didn't happen, no, it didn't happen, they would have just kept giving him more lies.
I mean, you know, if people were prepared to encounter the legal system, which innocent people often are not, he should have insisted on having a lawyer present.
Right.
But he might not.
And then that's the other part. I don't know if my dad ever did, and if he did, I don't know how long it took him to say something, because knowing my dad, he probably was kind of like, okay, this didn't happen. None of this is going to stick. So there's no point in getting a lawyer involved.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that was his thought process in the beginning.
Yeah, and again, it's perfectly reasonable. People don't know how broken the justice system is. And if they decide that you're guilty, you need to use every protection you have. And I mean, I can guarantee that if your father was from a rich family, he would have had a lawyer present, because if he talked to his parents or his brothers or sisters and there was money in the family, they would have said, get a lawyer and shut up. Right.
Right.
But they can take advantage. I mean, I don't think your father was of great means. He was an independent businessman.
Mm-hmm.
He ran an electronics repair shop or something.
He was able to, you know, retain a lawyer. Unfortunately, that lawyer, I feel, did not. I feel like his lawyer at the time back then did not do everything in his power to fact check everything. Because I feel like with my dad's case, if somebody would have just took the time and doubled over everything, you would have realized that none of it made sense.
Right.
From the way that I was testifying on the stand to even in the testimony, because in the transcript, I was supposed to have described being on my knees and my dad inserting his penis in my mouth. At 8 years old, if I would have been on my knees, there's no way in the world possible physically.
Right.
That he would have been able to put his penis in my mouth.
Right. Yes. Now, was this lawyer like a court-appointed lawyer, or did
no.
you?
No.
He was a page.
Because my father's mother, she paid a lot of money for that lawyer. And that was the same lawyer that he went to when I recanted.
You went...
And although it was smart for him to record me recanting, I wish he would have did a better job of... After I recanted, I wish he would have did a better job of being around. Because after I recanted with him on camera, which the video is out with me with the dog, rubbing and petting the dog. After that had happened, the prosecutors came back to me and they were like, well, we heard that you recanted and we need to say that that was a lie. Because if you don't say that it was a lie, then you're pretty much perjuring. Because I remember 8 years old is the first time I ever heard perjure. And I thought that was crazy because I was like, that's an interesting word. And I didn't really understand what it meant. But they just kept telling me like, okay, well, then your mother perjured. And now not only will you not have daddy, but you won't have mommy either. Mommy and both go bye-bye for a long time. You know what I mean? And as a kid, when you tell a kid something like that, it's kind of just like, okay, well, I don't want both my parents gone. So let me just undo whatever I just did.
Right. So you were under duress from your mother to testify originally, and then once the prosecution had you, you were under duress from them.
I was, like, under duress from them to keep the story going.
When did you finally decide, after the testimony and after your father had been jailed with his 20 to 40 year sentence, how old were you when you decided that you were going to speak out and say that it was all a lie?
Believe it or not, it had been many years. Many
right.
years had passed. Like, and it was in 2012 that I got I don't remember if it was a phone call or a letter. I think it was a phone call. It was a phone call from a man named Dan Slepian, who works for NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And he had let me know that my dad had contacted him, and he wasn't going to wait for my dad to say anything to me. He was like, no, I wanted to get on this now. And because he was so passionate about it, and I was like, this is somebody who understands that this is the truth. And I was like, I can be 100% honest with this person. And that's what I did. I was completely 100% honest with Dan. Dan, he got into the powers that be, and we did a segment for NBC. And Dan has just kind of, he's been guiding me on with whatever information that he can get. He's been guiding me on with how to go about it, who to talk to, stuff like that. Because even the petition between my grandmother, they both were just kind of like, maybe you should do a petition. Everybody seems to be doing a petition. Maybe you should try a petition. So I, on the whim, I was just like, you know what? Why not? Let's do it. So I did the petition, and I'm still reacted at the fact that it's like 196 or 197,000
signatures.
Mm-hmm. Because it was about 3,000 away from 200,000.
Mm.
And this is not people that I pay. These are not even people that I talk to. Some of them are people that I know, but most of them are people who believe that I'm telling the truth, and I wish these people were part of the judicial system. You have no idea, because my life would be so much easier.
Right. Well, I think if people educated themselves about how many injustices have been perpetrated by the so-called justice system, they would be a lot more skeptical about these convictions.
Right.
I think the last show I did on the justice system was a family, the mother and father were accused of shaking their baby, and the father was sent to jail for similar to your dad. The mother, they dropped the charges, but anyway.
And that's crazy, because if the baby died, the baby did die, correct?
No, the baby's healthy.
Oh, the baby didn't die?
The baby ended up in the hospital. I think the baby had a stroke and a seizure, But anyway, the baby got taken away from the mother, even though she was never charged. Well, like she was charged and they dropped the charges, but she was never convicted, tried or convicted of anything. Despite that, the baby recovered from what this episode was of a stroke or something. The baby's still not with the mother, and her other two children were also taken away. I mean, that's just an illustration of how the justice system can get everything screwed up, despite the fact that they had witnesses, medical witnesses.
And you know what's the sad part about that reality? The sad part about that reality is they have taken those kids away from that mother, and that's going to be it. When the mother is ready to take those kids, if it's been a certain amount of time, they will surely jump in there and put in their 2 cents and wave their finger around and talk about how much time has passed and how the mother, if she really wanted them, then this would have happened sooner. Because the justice system is just that ugly. It is that ugly I don't even know what to call it. It's that terrible that when things work for them, they will use them for their own hidden agenda. And when I say them, I'm talking about the people in the judicial system. There are some people in the judicial system who are looking for the truth, they're looking for justice, and they're fighting to right the wrongs and everything like that. But 80% of it is just all people with hidden agendas, and they're motivated by promotion and raises and making sure that they're good and their family's good, and they will knock over whatever family that they have. I mean, they will knock over whatever families that come along.
You
know what I mean?
Right.
To elevate themselves. And it's sad. It is really sad, because that's not what it should be based off of.
Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty obvious that if there was no medical evidence that you were raped, and the only testimony was the testimony of an 8-year-old who seemed to be wanting to recant the testimony, you'd think somebody would have said, look, this is maybe... a woman having a spat with her husband, her partner. Maybe that's where this came from. I mean, did you ever think why your mother did this?
No, I didn't. I have thought about it, but I haven't came up with a reason as to why. I have theories in my head, but I don't have any reason as to why. And I feel for my mother because her life hasn't been easy. And I used to be very upset with her for a very, very long time. For a very long time, I used to be mad at my mother. I wouldn't say that she was my mother. I would refer to her by first name only. Like, I was very upset with her. And then when I started learning about everything that happened in this case, that's when I was kind of like, oh, you know what? Maybe I should be a little bit easier on my mother, and I can get more information out of her to figure out what exactly was happening here.
And
like, me and my mom, we're okay now.
Right.
But still, I still feel for her because my mom wants to help, but it's just kind of like, she's like, I was doing so many drugs back then. I'm not sure left from right. And I'm just like, just dig in your heart and just try and figure out what's right and what's wrong and what's real and what's not.
Because although you have said that your testimony was not true, it would be even more powerful if your mother said, I told her to say this.
And you know what's crazy? My father has letters from her. And I swear my mom has done an affidavit that says that she was under a lot of drugs and a lot of stress. And she backs me in saying that the whole crime and story, she it's documented that she has done that.
So she has basically also recanted. Now, it did get to the point of a hearing. It went in like 2013 or so.
The review board that I was
And so the review board, they heard from you, obviously?
Yes. They were supposed to look into my father's case and see if there was anything done wrong that would be a means for reopening the case.
Right.
And so they didn't, I forget how long they were looking into it. Yes, I went up to New York 2 times, and they video recorded me in my interview with 3 people. One person was a detective, another person was a retired district attorney, and then there was one female who was, I don't know exactly who she was, I just know she was with the Special Victims Unit, which I only thought that was on TV. So when she said it, I was like, oh, shoot, this is real.
Yeah. Right. This is live TV.
Yeah, and for the simple fact that in the beginning, it was very nice, it was very cordial, and then when it got to the time of the case, and I'm explaining to them that everything is fabricated, none of this stuff is true. Like, none of this stuff is true. And I'm telling them, even though the story was fabricated, it was not true.
Right.
I'm like, you guys know that it's not true, because look at the simple fact. I'm like, my hymen was intact. There was no anal tearing. There was no vaginal tearing at all.
Right.
None of that.
So and
for,
I mean,
you guys to, for you guys to convict my dad of rape and sodomy, and there is no evidence of it.
That seems pretty compelling, because no matter what they think about mm-hmm. your honesty, your father's honesty, your mother's honesty, the
you
fact...
You can always depend on science.
Well, I don't go that far. But I mean, this is pretty straightforward. Like, if a man rapes an 8-year-old, there's going to be signs. There
right.
has to be some, right? I mean, an 8-year-old's not
right,
developed.
Exactly.
I mean, that just seems so brutally obvious. But it wasn't good enough. They denied the
right.
appeal.
And that's the thing that bothers me, because while talking to the members of that committee, or three members of that committee, the special victims lady was pretty much telling me, like, well, maybe it did happen. Maybe you're suppressing these feelings. I think that you are just really very merciful, and you're very... Yes, and you know, they were just like, well, we commend you for wanting to get your father out and all this other stuff. And I'm like, it's not about getting him out from fighting my wrong. I'm telling them this, and I kept reiterating it, but it was just like they would put up their hands. Well, they wouldn't physically put their hands over their ears, but it was just like they weren't listening to me. And I felt like, once again, I was this 7-year-old being forced on what to feel and what to say.
That's pretty incredible that they were charged with unbiasedly examining whether there was anything worth reconsidering.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that they're behaving like they're just trying to impose.
It was more like they were trying to protect themselves and whoever that they knew. You know what I mean? Like, okay,
yes.
Well, go ahead and give us your side. We'll sit here and listen since we can... You know what I mean? That's how I really felt, like they handcuffed me.
They handcuffed you, in a sense.
Yeah. So, like, they were just kind of like, well, we have to interview you, so I guess we'll sit down here and pretend we'll know what you have to say. But in the meantime, they have great turkey subs down the block. You know what I mean?
Yes,
like,
yes.
I felt like I was the only one being serious in that moment. And then the other thing about it, because you brought up the bias part, My father has an attorney, and that attorney actually set me down in front of a very well-known, he's a psychologist. He's an adolescent and adult psychologist who deals with victims of sexual trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And he went through the whole entire report that the committee came up with, and he interviewed me himself.
Right.
And he said that the report that the committee came up with is completely biased. It's completely biased for the simple fact of the board has not interviewed me, and me and my grandmother and my mother were the only people that were physically interviewed. Everybody else was interviewed, like, over the phone, or they were just like, we couldn't contact them.
Right.
Everybody else involved in the case. And for everybody that they did sit down and talk to, which was me, my mother, and my grandmother, our views are completely biased, is what they say about us.
So they're accusing...
Even though the whole report is biased.
Right. They're basically accusing everybody who's living, who was involved in the case, of lying.
Mm-hmm.
You retracted
Except for the people on their side.
Well,
when it comes to the people on their side, it was kind of like, oh, they were professionally mannered, and their mind was in the right place, and they're doing very well in life. I'm like, what does that have to do with the fact that this is a lie? All the extra stuff that you're writing about these people, it doesn't matter.
Well, what kinds of people? I mean, explain other people, because...
The DA was one of the people were supposed to interview. And then the nurse, and all there was the redness.
So the nurse who had done the physical examination?
Yes. And then that was another thing that was pointed out to me, is there may have been a doctor, but there were doctors signing off his paperwork.
There weren't. There were no doctors signing paperwork, just nurses.
No, it was a nurse. It was a nurse who told, I guess she told the detectives and stuff that were there, like, oh, yeah, there are signs of physical trauma. And I'm like, how can a nurse do that? You're not qualified to do that. You're not even qualified to tell me if my test results are good or bad, but you are telling this detective that there are signs of sexual abuse. And to me, that was a red flag.
Yeah, like you...
I'm like, nobody talked about that in the report.
I mean, you can see, with all respect to nurses, there's lots of times where nurses can work autonomously, but here you're talking about a serious situation. Apart from actually killing somebody, this is considered one of the most serious crimes. In fact, your father was sentenced to more years than many murderers. Recently, mm-hmm. was a guy, I just read today, of a case where a guy shot his daughter's boyfriend and buried him under manure on his farm, and he got a 10-year sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So this is taken 2 to 4 times more seriously than murder, and yet it doesn't seem like the scientific side of it really was.
Not at all. Nothing seems to add up in the case except for the fact that my dad was lied to by police. His reasoning for the lies that they gave him were rationalized to fit the side of, you know, the judicial side,
mm-hmm.
or the judicial side, where they're just like, well, he came up with excuses to lie, so he's guilty. Like, that doesn't make you guilty. What makes you guilty is when you can put the person at the crime, when you can show that they actually did it. They have nothing to show that my father actually did anything, because nothing ever happened.
Yes. Now, another, quote, mistake that your father made was that he lied in his trial about his military service. And although this shouldn't have, or exaggerated his military service, it shouldn't have anything to do with whether he raped you or not. It was used as evidence that he was a liar, and therefore he mm-hmm. couldn't be believed about his denials about sexual assaulting you either.
And that helped them. That was their gold mine right there. That was their gold mine. Because it was just kind of like, well, that proves that he's a liar, and then the fact that he was coming up with excuses to these lies that we fed him during interrogation tells you that he's guilty.
I mean, that's kind of ironic.
Like, Yeah, I'm like, that is not how the scales of justice is supposed to work.
I mean, it's kind of ironic that the police, just as a natural course of business, lied to your father to try to get on a very important issue, lied on a very important issue to try to get a conviction, and your father lied or exaggerated about something that really is irrelevant to the trial. Maybe it goes to his...
To the case, and that... relevancy is what, that makes me so mad, because that's what put so much time on his sentence. Because the judge, he was a war veteran. So he was that when he discovered that my father exaggerated the morale of his service. And I talked to my dad about that. My dad was like, I don't remember saying anything about Purple Heart or anything like that. He was like, I don't remember saying any of that.
He might have just been misunderstood.
For me, that's a toss up in the air. Right. It could have been he was misunderstood. It could have been that he didn't say anything of the sort. And they're making this up. I feel stuck, because I'm like, all I know is what I know. And that's all I can tell you. And I felt like with that committee, when I was in the committee, I feel like they wanted me to give them answers for everybody. Like, they wanted me to give them answers for my father's actions. They wanted answers for my grandmother's actions. They wanted answers for my mother's actions. And I was telling them, I don't know why everybody else did what they did. Because to me, it was like, they were just like, you know, why do you think your mom did it? And why do you think your father said that? And I kept telling them, I do not know. I do not know why everybody else did what they did. For my mom, I have any ideas on why my mom did what but only she would know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, people do some pretty irrational things when mm-hmm. they're on drugs. I mean, we see that all the time.
Yeah, so but her being on drugs is not good enough for them. That's the thing that made me scratch my head, because I'm like, she was on drugs. Is that not an excuse in itself? And they're just like, no, but even with the drugs, like, why would you think that your mom would come up with these ideas? And why would your mom feel like your father is touching you? And I kept telling him, I do not know why my mom felt that way.
Well, I mean, your mom was taking cocaine, which does induce paranoia, right? So
right. And then the way that you're just like, well, cocaine can induce paranoia. That's what you said. For me, I'd be like, okay, understandable. That's a valid excuse. But if I were to say that to them, they'd be like, yeah, but with that, all that aside, yeah. Why do you think? You know what I mean? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. She was like, but that wasn't good enough for them. They wanted.
How did your father handle the fact that your testimony had sent him to jail?
To be honest with you, I don't know. To me, my answer would just be the best way he could. But I know that when I saw, the first time I saw my dad after his conviction and everything like that, he wasn't mad with me or anything. He just hugged me. We cried together. We cried I cried more than he did, but we cried for a little bit. We hugged most of the time, and it was a regular jail visit. You know, he was paying attention to my mom, my brothers and sisters, but he had me under his arm. He didn't really want to let me go. He told me that he forgave me and, you know, that none of it is my fault.
That's pretty big of him to do that. And what about the relationship with your brothers and sisters afterwards?
Well, my brothers and sisters, now that I'm older, it's kind of like I have a broader view of how things were. It was more so like growing up, it was like a cover-up kind of. So, like, my brothers and sisters didn't really know. They had no idea. And it wasn't until everything started coming out that they were just like, okay, the world knows more than we do. So what should we be prepared for, you know?
Right.
My brothers and sisters have had their moments, each one, where they get mad at me and they say their little things, like, you know, it's their fault that daddy's locked away and our life would be different if it weren't for you. I've had that too as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that. I mean, I don't think the justice system really cares about the impact on the family. And I mean, I guess if your father really did what he did, then you can say, well, you know, we just got to put that aside, right? It's not our job to look after the family. But, you know, if there were any qualms about what they were doing, you'd think they would have thought, you know, if we put this guy away illegally, that's going to destroy so many relationships and so many people's lives.
Earlier, that these people that are involved in, well, the bottom part, that are involved in the judicial system, they don't care. You have a couple that care, but most of them don't care. Like the detectives that ripped our family apart, they don't care. The DA that ripped our family apart, they don't care. They don't care. They all had their own hidden agendas. They all had their dreams of careers. They didn't care.
Dreams of being elevated, being promoted in the service. And are some of them still, this is 20 years ago, are some of them still working?
If I'm not mistaken, the DA, the DA who was the prosecutor in the case, if I'm not mistaken, she is retired. And she's enjoying it. Because they put us face-to-face. They put us face-to-face when I went up to meet the committee in New York. And that also I thought was pretty unprofessional. But they put us down face-to-face. And she was like, you know, I've been wondering about you all these years, blah, blah, blah. And I pretty much told her, none of this happened. And blame you. Because you didn't do the legwork. You just did the court stuff. Which, I mean, that was still big too. But to me, the problem, or the primary problem, was the police. Because if it would have been figured out from there, it would have never went to court.
Well, it's kind of like the nurse had a critical part to play. I mean, if she had said, you know, there's some redness, but that's normal and there's no sign of a vaginal or anal sexual penetration, that would have probably been it, right? Without that testimony from her, the whole thing would have fallen apart. So she bears a lot of responsibility. I mean, I think there's a lot of blame to go around in these cases.
Right.
How did you survive this horrible and dramatic event in your life? Losing your father, potentially forever?
You know what's so interesting to me when you asked me that? Because when I was meeting with the DA from back then, she had said to me that she had asked me towards the end of it, like, "Oh, Shanann, how are you? You know, how are you doing?" And she said that I said to her that all I can do is adapt and move on. I don't know if I was 8 or 9 when I said it, but, you know, she said that's what I said. And I believe I probably did say that, because I feel like that's how I've always felt about life.
Right.
That you want, because guess what? The sun will go up and the moon will go away and the sun will come up and it's a whole new day. So now it's just about trying to right that wrong.
Right.
Like, so much time go past with me not being able to do anything.
Yes, and are there ongoing efforts to try to free your father?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, something about he's done a lot of appeals, and I don't know if he's used all his stuff, but he's got, I think, all his appeals denied. And the furthest that we have gotten is the review committee that I was talking about. Right now, it's just waiting to see if he'll be granted parole.
Well, it's been almost
next December.
Right. So a 20-to-40-year sentence means that you can get parole after 20 years, and 40 years is the maximum they can keep you in for. Is that correct?
Oh, I the sentencing and all that legal stuff.
But he could potentially be paroled soon. I mean, and then maybe afterwards they'll find him innocent. After 20 years.
Yes, he could be paroled soon. And what I've prepared thus far is, I mean, hopefully not too lengthy, but it's a letter for the parole board, because my father told me that I do have an option called the victim impact speech.
Right.
And he didn't tell me what to say or anything like that. He was just like, just know that you can speak to the board because and you have something called a victim impact.
Right.
So I plan on using that as my pedestal to remind. Yeah, I was going to use my victim impact speech as to remind them that, you know, the situation that we're in is not me or my father. It's not our thing right now. It's in the judicial system. Show them that this crime is non-existent.
Yes. I mean, that's actually, people who are innocent are in a much more difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go in the parole...
You have to wait for people to do their job.
Well, no, but it's not that. It's like if you go to the parole board and say, "I'm innocent, I should be let out," the parole board is going to say, "Well, that's none of our business. It's not us who finds you guilty or innocent. We're trying to find out whether you've overcome what you did." So you have to go to the parole board and say...
That's also part of my speech as well.
Yeah, like you have to go... You're supposed to go to the parole board and say, "I'm really sorry I did what I did. I've worked really hard on, you know, on all the different things to overcome that. I'm a better person now." But if you go up there and say, "I'm still innocent. I was innocent when you put me in jail. I'm still innocent today," the parole board's likely to say you're in denial.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I don't know how best to handle a parole board hearing when you truly believe that you're innocent. That's beyond me.
Yeah, and like I've pretty much have started preparing my letter, and then I decided I want to tweak it a little bit.
Yes.
Stating, like, I understand that with parole boards and everything like that, you're looking for remorse. You're looking for an understanding, a readjustment back to society. You're looking for all these different things. And I guarantee my father has all these things, but the one thing that he's not going to have is remorse. And I'm explaining to them, he's not going to have remorse because there's nothing to be remorseful about because nothing ever happened. And I've been spending the last years trying to get the judicial system to understand this so that way we wouldn't be at this point. But unfortunately, we are at this point, and they are literally out of ears that I feel listen to me for them to understand my father's situation.
Have you ever felt throughout this whole thing, there's a lot of people in the past, sexual assault of children and women was not taken that seriously. In this case, it was taken seriously. It just didn't happen. Have you felt that some people feel that your case is dangerous?
By frowning upon it?
Yeah, because you're saying, well, you know, sometimes these things didn't actually happen when people said they didn't happen.
Well, here's what I feel like is the difference. I feel like the difference is that, number one, I was a child. Number two, I didn't go to the police and claim rape or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So that's the difference in the situation. In those situations, the women that are raped, they should go to the police. They should absolutely go to the police.
Right.
And I believe that whoever has done it should be, you know, they should be prosecuted to the full extent of a just law. It should be
right.
A fair law. In my situation, I did not go to the police. My mother did not go to the police. My grandmother is the one that involved the police into the situation. And the police, they pretty much turn an anthill into a mountain because, you know, them talking with the nurses and everything like that, they decided they could probably...
They decided that your dad was guilty and built the case around that.
Honestly, us being in New York, you probably don't know much about Newburgh, New York. But Newburgh, New York is a very small city. It is very,
right.
very small. It couldn't be any more than 25 miles long from side to side, top to bottom. And everybody knows everybody. And it is a poor black city.
Right.
It is a very, very black city. And the cops, you know, it's kind of like when you have a poor black city, and I hate to bring it down to race and stuff like that, but when you have a poor black city, you're pretty much just picking out who you want to go to prison and, you know, continue to run your prison slave trade. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So with a crime of such that my dad had, they were probably looking like, you know what? Yeah, we can get him for a lot of years, so this will work out. And then the DA was probably like, yeah, we just need to find some things that we can get to stick.
I mean,
And that's exactly what they did.
Right. And legitimately, I mean, everybody should want to put child molesters in jail, just like they should want to put
right.
rapists of adults in jail. But that doesn't mean that we should jump past the evidence in both of those cases, that we should assume from the beginning that one side is right and the other side's wrong, and then just try to make the evidence fit.
And you know what? You know what just weirds me out about this whole situation is that with my father, this did not happen. The victim says that, and the alleged convict says that. You get what I'm saying? They both
yes.
are telling you that it's not happened. And my dad was still given 20 to 40 years, whereas people like Jared Fogle, who have admitted to the crime and sleeping with kids, and admitting to having my children so he can have sex with them, they're on house arrest. You're living in your house with a bracelet. Like, this is crazy to me, but this is the judicial system that we live in.
Well, like I said, you know, a guy's sentenced to 10 years for murder, and I'm not saying that child abuse is not a serious crime, but it seems out of line to have 20 to 40 years for child abuse and 10 years for murder. Like, that just seems kind of out of line.
For me, I just think it's crazy because I can't get past the Jared Fogle issue.
Because
yes. to me, that still deals with children.
Right.
You're still having sex. And on top of that, you paid these kids to have sex with them. So not only do you have, you're having sex with children, but that's equivalent to sex trafficking. A child.
Because
you're paying them for sex.
You think that would be a far worse crime.
Yes. I think something like that deserves 20 to 40 years. You understand what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
It baffles me. And this is the stuff that I have to see on TV, and it's like a smack in the face. For all the people that I keep telling that it didn't happen, and I'm waiting for them to do their job and let other people know that it didn't happen, and then write whatever legal stuff that is wrong to write it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But I have to sit here and watch Jared Fogle, who can go to the grocery store. I'm sure he could spend time with his kids. He could spend the holidays with his kids. Like, it's crazy to me.
Yes. No, I agree. This situation is completely crazy. I find it, amazing that you did what you did to right the wrong that you didn't even create in the first place, but you were obviously involved with it. And you know, to be fighting for your dad for so many years is really admirable. And all I can do is wish you and your dad and the rest of your family the best.
No, we appreciate it, and we look forward to talking even more to everybody when my dad is out, so you guys can really get the legal point of view, because while my dad has been incarcerated, he has been getting degrees, doing everything that he needs to do.
Well, when he gets out, I'd love to interview him. I hope
that's
soon.
I guarantee you, he will not have, he will.
Pardon me, I missed you there.
You
started saying, I can guarantee.
I can guarantee you my dad won't even be looking forward to sitting down and relaxing. The first thing he's going to want to do, besides see the kids and the grandkids and everything, is probably go out and speak on exactly how he feels in his situation and try and help others who are in his situation.
This happens far too often. Anyway,
far too often.
Thank you for joining me today, Chinea. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Again, I apologize for the audio problems in this interview, but I hope you found that it was very interesting and important. For more information, see the show notes for a link to the excellent 2013 New York Magazine article and a link to a new petition to review the conviction of Chinea's father. Thank you for listening to episode 147 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.